there's something undefinable that beckons travelers back to the greater Fort Myers area in southwest Florida year after year. It feels like bare feet on soft white sand beaches that give way to gently lapping waves. It looks like the breathtaking abundance of wildlife, colorful birds, dolphins, manatees, and more, dwelling in lush mangrove ecosystems and translucent Gulf waters. It tastes like fresh coastal cuisine served at sunset at a waterfront restaurant. What will draw you back to Fort Myers? Go to visitfortmyers.com for more inspiration.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your riffing lick and lick and riff of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. You give more than me, and you live like men and women in the shade, more than me. Yes, you hide like men and women, men and women. We are back for part two of the Village Voice Memory Lane Walk. We are back now with a whole new set of folks bringing us up out of the 80s into the 90s and into the 2000s. So this week, we're going to talk to Evelyn McDonald. We're going to talk to Chuck Eddy, Rob Harvilla, and Tom Bryan. But let's start with a call with Ann Powers. Many, many luminaries who have passed through the pages of the New York Times also passed through the pages of the Village Voice. One of those people is Ann Powers. Ann is currently a critic and correspondent for NPR Music, wrote quite a bit for the Times back in the day, and was at the Voice from 93 to 96, initially as feminist editor, which she will explain a little bit what that was, and then subsequently as music editor. And Ann is in Nashville pondering Americana and calling in right now. Ann, what's up?
Hey, just waiting for the deluge of twang next week.
I sort of assume it's just a constant deluge of trying. How can you distinguish? All my friends in Nashville.
Twang off my shoes.
Nashville's now a no-fly zone for me. I'm not allowed in town anymore.
You're always welcome in my side of town.
Thank you. That's right. So tell me about what the Voice that you arrived into was like, because this is the period. So 93, that's the year I graduated high school. I've been reading the Voice 2 or 3 years and getting like obviously overwhelmed by it and like all everything that it is pulsing through it. For you as a writer and editor, what did you feel like you were arriving into?
Well, I was arriving, I've said this before, but I was arriving into my dream, my fantasy of what a publication could be. And it was very connected with my personal life, of course, because at the time I was already involved with my now husband, Eric Weisbard, yep. whom I met in the Bay Area. And he had come out to the Bay Area to go to grad school. As a dyed-in-the-wool New Yorker, he was, he grew up on The Voice and was extremely devoted to music criticism. And growing up, I knew of The Voice, but I was a West Coaster and, was more in touch with the LA Weekly. I wrote for the LA Weekly and the SF Weekly. I was an editor there. But after I met Eric and we started dating, I really got into The Voice and started trying to write for them the way so many people did
yep.
by submitting to Paz and Job.
Yep.
I got some comments accepted the first year that I tried, which was very exciting. And from then on, it sort of became my dream, my ideal. My first thing I published there was this think piece, of course, like multi-artist review. I think it was Tori Amos, Tanita Tikaram, and someone else. I don't know, but it was called Ride the Unicorn. That was the name of the piece.
It's a very Voice roundup and a very Voice headline.
I know.
Tori Amos and Tanita Tikaram. Yeah, that's...
Yeah, right, exactly. And I can't remember if PJ Harvey was in there, but I wrote about her pretty soon after. Joe Levy was my editor at the time, although Bob was the one who kind of got me in there at first through the passing job. And, Joe was just an amazing editor, truly the king of the line editors. And I was reading The Voice, you know, devotedly at that time. And so when I came to New York to work for The New York Times, it was like The Voice was my side piece, I guess.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, I was like, The Voice was still had my heart in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. And when they had this job open up to be feminist editor, I just was like, oh my gosh, I can work there in Cooper Square in that office with all those amazing people, all those amazing writers whom I idolize. And I left at the chance.
Can you talk about the critical legacy that you were coming into on the music side? When I think of, obviously, the voice writing of the 70s and 80s and some of the really powerful voices that I'm sure shaped all of us to different degrees.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you could talk about people or pieces that you read that really...
Yeah, influence. Legacy-wise, my love of the voice extended across the sections. It wasn't just the music section, so... Equally influential to me were the film writers, Hoberman, yeah. Amy Taubin, especially. She was like one of my favorite writers of all time. I loved the Voice Literary Supplement, which at the time M. Mark was editing. Feature writers like Jan Hoffman, to me, were the greatest, you know. And then, of course, on the music side, there were so many amazing writers and people who kind of crossed back and forth. Greg Tate was writing about music, but, of course, writing about culture in general.
Everything. Yeah.
Lisa Kennedy and Lisa Jones were both very important to me. Lisa Kennedy was the film editor when I got there. And Lisa Jones, man, I feel like she is still one of the great essayists and writers of my generation. The thing was, it was all about being in that office and these people being nearby or like walking past or engaging you in conversation.
Yeah.
And I would get so tongue-tied when some of these writers would come by. But then in the music section, there was so much camaraderie. Like I said, Joe was such a great line editor and also a hilarious person.
Yes.
And just, I was reading something the other day about, you know, what was it like to go through those long edits of The Voice, which we had, which were so amazing, that were like was just a treasure for a young writer.
Yeah.
Where you would sit for hours and work on a piece line by line. And I was on both sides of that. I mean, doing that with Joe, doing that with Bob sometimes, doing that also with Richard Goldstein,
yes.
who I think he, you know, he published his memoir last year, and he's one of the great forgotten, like semi-forgotten, hopefully now remembered, rock writers,
yep.
and brilliant guy, and such an open, generous heart, the great editors. And then on the other side, I remember... I used to edit this column that was, I guess it was in the Rock and Roll Quarterly, maybe, which was a quarterly we put out every
yes.
quarter.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Right.
Well, Evelyn McDonald's part of this conversation. Rock, she wrote, our anthology came out of an article she wrote for the Rock and Roll Quarterly about women music writers.
Yes,
but
and everybody
anyway,
go
I
cop
remember.
Rock, she wrote. Please, cop Rock,
oh,
she wrote.
Thank you.
Please. No, seriously.
But,
fire.
Rock, she wrote, actually has a lot of pieces from The Voice,
yeah.
maybe to a fault.
Well, but I was curious because I wonder, criticism often was especially rock criticism, was obviously a very heavily male sport. And there were key female practitioners before, you know, your era and The Voice. But
yeah.
I wonder if you found The Voice to be hospitable to a wide range of voices. Did you feel it was a good place for women to come and write? Did you what was the climate?
Oh my
like?
Gosh. It was such a great place for women. I was actually reflecting on that, John, just this morning and thinking, I wonder if others had a different experience than I did because, you know, this is a moment when we're hearing of things we didn't know happened, you know, but I never experienced any negativity around my gender at The Voice. In fact, quite the opposite. And so many of my heroes were women. Like I said, Lisa Jones, Cindy Carr, also amazing
yes.
art critic. She was so great. Donna Gaines was around. Carol Cooper, who is just one of my favorite writers of all time. She was writing about R&B and all sorts of stuff beyond R&B. Daisanne McLean, who went on to be a food writer and actually worked for The Times, I think, for a while. She was writing about Latin music. I remember she did a Mark Anthony feature for us. So there's just like so many people. Mim Yudovich, like I just have to say all praise Mim Yudovich. I loved her writing on celebrity. She was one of those great celebrity profilers and a person writing about pop. It's arguable that she was the one who invented poptimism, not Jody Rosen or me or Carl Wilson or you or whoever.
I don't claim that. I don't. I don't bang with poptimism.
Well, I'm post-poptimism.
You can't rep something you're already past.
But anyway, I'm just like throwing out a million names.
Right.
But I just felt like, there were so many great women writers throughout The Voice.
And I wonder, before we go, I wonder if there are any, whether it's particular pieces that you wrote or edited that really stuck in your mind as like, oh, this could only happen at The Voice or, you know, something, you know, because I know even just as a freelancer, I look back at some of those pieces and I was like, yo, no place would have published this except The Village Voice.
Absolutely. Two that spring to my mind. And they were both edited by Richard Goldstein. One was a feature I wrote called Queer in the Streets, Straight in the Sheets, Notes on Passing, that was about this idea of the lesbian continuum and queer straight identity. If this piece resurfaces, maybe from this podcast, perhaps I will get slaughtered for it. But at the time, it was pre-Twitter. But, you know, it was a deep inquiry into issues around gender and sexuality through my own lens of my own experience. Another piece was this one I did on in defense of nasty art, quote unquote, or transgressive art. And that's a funny one to think of now because we had like a kind of collage of Old Dirty Bastard and Trent Reznor on the cover together.
Wow. That's very, very Village Voice 90s / very, very 2018.
Yeah. So true. What goes around comes around. But, you know, pieces like that piece really like was asking questions about, is there a use for music or film or visual art that addresses like difficult subject matter and transgressive subject matter? And I, of course, was the big flag waver that we need to embrace this stuff and, you know, visit our darkness through art. I was really like that in the 90s. I was super, super liked to visit my darkness through art back then. But yeah, pieces like that. I remember Richard edited a whole thing about religion, like all these little mini memoirs of all of us writing about our religious experiences. I wrote a piece about being a lapsed Catholic and my eternal love for U2. And
it's interesting. Yes. And we have talked about U2 and the religious impulse on podcast before. And also to that point, I do remember one of the things I really enjoyed about being just in The Voice, you know, umbrella, never on staff, but just nearby, is you would get asked to contribute to just whatever, like, you know, I did film reviews. I maybe did a book review. I think I maybe did something in a sex issue. Like it's just, you know, if you were a voice writer, you were a voice writer. And it was incidental what your specialty was. You were just kind of like taken into the whole thing.
That was what was so great. The dialogue just really crossed every boundary, except for me, a couple boundaries. I never really talked to Nat Hentoff. He just like intimidated me so much. I never ventured in there into that crazy, messy office of his. Although I did talk all the time to Gary Giddens and learned a lot about jazz from talking to him. And Leighton Koerner, who was the classical critic, and Kyle Gann, who I love. And we actually did a dialogue. Kyle and I once did a dialogue about Yoko Ono, which was so fun. Like Kyle talking about Yoko from his perspective as a classical and new music composer and critic, and me talking about her as a pop writer. And I remember after Yoko, I ran into her somehow, and she hugged me, and I was like, thank you, Village Voice, for giving me the opportunity to hug Yoko Ono. So, you know, what else would I want in life?
Well, Anne, thank you so much for calling and sharing a few things with us today. I'm really grateful, and I'm glad we could celebrate The Voice a little bit together.
Long live The Village Voice.
True story.
China, all the way to New. I can feel the distance getting close. You're right next to me, but I need an airplane
So after Ann Powers was the music editor of the Village Voice, she handed off the section to Evelyn McDonald. Evelyn is currently the director of journalism at Loyola Marymount in Los Angeles, and Evelyn's calling in from her office in LA today. How's it going?
It's going great. Thanks.
Evelyn, you took over for Ann in the mid-90s, but you had been at The Voice for a few years prior. Tell us about how you first came to The Voice.
Well, I first came to The Voice, I think in late 1988, as a copy editor. And I did copy edit there for several years. And I actually became this thing called a buff.
A buff.
Which was unique to The Voice.
Yes. Tell me about buffs.
So the buffs were a gift of unions, all respect to labor.
That's right. Shout out to the News Guild, proud union member.
So they were bargaining unit freelancers. And they were people who wrote enough for The Voice that they got union benefits, including health insurance.
What?
Yep. So this was an amazing benefit that kept people writing for them for a long time, and that drove management crazy because essentially people were getting union benefits without getting outright hired. But of course, it was, you know, to prevent them from just using freelancers and instead of hiring people, right?
Yeah, I was unaware of that, but that makes a lot of sense. And obviously, like labor history and the Village Voices history, there's a lot of intersections. I know there's strikes that are happening in the 80s and so on and so forth. Voice took unionization very seriously. Voice writers.
Right. And definitely. And this was, you know, one of the key gains they made, along, of course, with rights for same-sex couples that they were, I think, pioneers on. And very crucial members of the community were buffs, including like Michael Musto, Manola Dargis. Manola Dargis and I were union stewards for the buffs together.
Oh, wow.
As a voice. I know.
Oh, wow. Love you, Manola. Yeah. Love you.
So, yeah, which is, I mean, so I think that they were an immense benefit to the paper because I think they enhanced the talent pool, but they were always something that every time there was a contract negotiation, they would try to get rid of the buffs altogether or, you know, change the conditions. And they did eventually, I think, really narrow who could become a buff.
And so you were a buff before you were a staffer?
Yes. Yeah.
So you were in this sort of like deep freelance through the 80s and early to mid 90s. You mentioned you were a copy editor. Also, were you writing at the same time?
Yeah, I was copy editing and writing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what were you writing about? Was it always music or was it other things?
It was other things as well. As a matter of fact, I wound up doing a lot of theater reviews when Ross Westone was the theater editor, rest in peace. And actually, I filled in for him as listings editor also a lot. You know, and then, of course, I was also writing a lot about the spoken word, downtown poetry.
Oh, were you covering, like, the New Eurekan and stuff like that?
Yes,
right.
I was the person who, you know, I was the first person to ever write about Paul Beatty.
Paul Beatty, man.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah, he's my man. I wrote about the New Eurekan. I wrote quite a bit about those sort of rising stars of that scene, and then sort of segued into writing about poetry and literature and theater and feminist issues.
And so when you came on, Anne had been the music editor, Anne Powers had been the music editor, and then you followed her. What kind of section did she bequeath you?
It was in great shape, and I had already written for, you know, before her, for Doug Simmons and for Joe Levy. So it was in great shape. I mean, we had so many stars like Greg Tate. I think Ben Ratliff was, I think he was just starting to write for The Voice when I think Anne brought him on, but I know I worked with him a lot. I think she bequeathed him to me. Gary Giddens, Lynn Kerner, of course, Bob was writing.
One of the things that's come up a lot in these conversations is sort of how what was happening in The Voice was not really happening in other publications, you know, the intensity of the criticism, the community of criticism. I'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
Right. So, I mean, you know, Bob Christgau had really built this incredible enterprise that I do feel that we were all carrying on to some degree of taking music seriously and writing about it in a literary fashion. And I think we all used that as a springboard and maybe took it in our own particular directions. I think for myself, partly because I was maybe coming out of writing a lot about the literary poetry scene, I was maybe trying to get more of that sensibility back into the section. Or actually, I don't know if that sensibility had been there that much before, although Jamaica Kincaid, you know, did write the Village Voice music section.
Oh, wow. I don't think I knew that.
Yes, she did. Yeah, she would not let us republish any of her works for Rock She Wrote, though. I think Bob brought her in. I did worry that sometimes criticism at The Voice, particularly in the music section, was too circular, too insider, and that sometimes we were writing too much for each other and not for a larger audience.
I think that's totally fair, and I think kind of was always the bargain slash problem with the section, which is you didn't stop to think about, well, what would a casual reader think? Like, how would it, you know, are you scared of putting off that person? That was never, it just, you know, in all the time when I was a writer, at subsequent to you being there, that's not a thing that ever came up. You know, it was never a conversation like, well, you should really try to present this in a way where just a punter on the street would know what this is. That was never a thing. It was like, be your most eccentric, most insider self.
I think that was a problem. And I think I tried to open that up. And also by bringing in maybe some other writers, or maybe focusing on some writers that I felt had that openness.
You and Anne also put together an anthology. Some of the writing comes from The Voice, the Rock She Wrote anthology.
Right.
That was reflective of a robust moment for women critics. And I wonder if you, did you feel like the section was always receptive? Was the paper always receptive to those voices? Do you feel that you were able to achieve more in the context of The Voice than you might have been able to achieve in a music publication or a different kind of outlet?
Rock She Wrote was, you know, built around the feminine critique, which was the Village Voice feature story that I wrote for, I think, the Rock and Roll Quarterly, another thing that had its moment.
Yes, R.I.P. the Rock and Roll Quarterly.
And I can say that I actually got two book deals out of my work for the Village Voice, because I got Rock She Wrote, and I also ended up writing the book about Rent that came out of my Rent story for the Village Voice, the musical Rent. So on the one hand, the Village Voice commissioned and really helped me come up with the idea for this piece that was searching for this lost history of women rock critics that came before Anne and I, right? So on the one hand, the Voice totally supported that piece and made it happen. You know, on the other hand, the piece is a criticism of this music criticism up until that day, which had not been supportive of women writers.
Exactly.
And, you know, the Village Voice had not had a woman music editor until Ann Powers and then myself. And until after that, that story came out. And I think that there were writers like myself that were supported and published and nurtured to a degree, but until we sort of raised the flag about it, we were not being given these positions. And there was also this thing that a lot of the women who were writing about music were in some way related to the men who were writing about music as spouses or siblings or, you know. So it was not as open as one would have hoped.
When did you decide to leave, and what did you leave for?
I left for love. Bye. Big mistake. probably the biggest mistake of my life, to be honest, on both sides of the equation.
Well, love will do that to you.
Yeah. So, but I have to say, I also left after Karen Durbin, who was the editor-in-chief who hired me after she was basically asked to leave. And I did feel that she was the one who'd brought me on board and that I'd lost my support. And love might not have seemed as enticing.
Under other circumstances.
But in retrospect, I wish I'd stayed.
When you left and went to write other places, like, I don't know, there was sort of a certain alchemy in the voice, in the writing, that I know when I wrote for The Voice, I felt something alchemical that I didn't necessarily feel when I wrote for other places as a free, you know, when I was freelancing. And I wonder, when you were writing elsewhere outside of The Voice, did you feel the same, whether it's freedom or flexibility, or was there something about The Voice that was different for you as a writer?
The Voice was definitely unique and special. And I mean, I do think that I carried so much of what I learned and developed there to all the writing I've done in my life, but I've probably never had so much freedom, and B, never had so much support. And what was really special about The Voice was the editing experience, mm-hmm. and the time that, and this is, you know, not just the music editing, this is different sections, the time that the editor would spend with you to go over your piece. And it didn't feel that they were trying to squelch your voice. It felt like they were trying to help bring your voice out and help you develop and grow. I have never experienced that anywhere else to that degree.
And also the readers. I mean, that, you know, the people who read the section took it seriously. You know, these are not sort of like casual drive-by fans. Like, these are people who want to engage with the ideas. And also, something that's come up in a few different interviews with different people is, I think especially in the 90s and prior to that, artists would read The Voice. Like, artists would felt that The Voice was a place where criticism was being practiced seriously, sometimes in their favor, sometimes not. So you really, you know, sometimes today I'll write something and I feel like, I don't know who's going to read this. You know, I don't know what person's going to read this. I don't know if it's going to have an effect. But I think back then, my sense is, you felt like you had like almost like a direct line to the people who cared the most about the subject.
Yeah, and everybody read The Voice, and you know, everybody picked it up every week, and it gave you a platform.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece, and in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS, not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Hi, this is Eric Kim with New York Times Cooking. As a recipe developer, I spend a lot of my time trying to come up with dishes that are quick, easy, but also very special. For me, that means dishes like gochugaru salmon. It's a crispy salmon fillet with a salty, sweet glaze that bubbles up and candies. I love cooking this because it only takes 20 minutes. I developed this recipe when I was down in Georgia with my family. It stars a Korean red pepper powder called gochugaru. I love the way it blooms in the maple syrup and the rice vinegar. If you don't have gochugaru, you should totally get some. It's super versatile. It's not just that it brings heat, but fruity sweetness as well. You can get this recipe and so many more ideas on New York Times Cooking. Visit nytcooking.com to get inspired.
When I did the intro for the first of these podcasts, I was talking about some of the pieces that I've written for The Voice over the years. And the very first piece that I wrote for The Voice, if I am not mistaken, was a short album review of Freestyle Fellowships To Whom It May Concern CD reissue, which appeared in a thin vertical column on the music page sometime in 1999, on the early part of 1999. The person who assigned me that is Chuck Eddy, and Chuck Eddy is on the phone from Austin. What's up, Chuck?
Oh, Chuck is vomit, John.
Hey! Strong bit. Strong bit.
Hey, you know how many times I've answered that question that way in my life. But anyway, I'm guessing the Freestyle Fellowship thing was probably the sidebar. It was kind of interesting.
It was a sidebar, yeah.
The first page of the section was kind of uniform in certain ways, if I remember right, where there was sort of like a short piece running down the side and a short one at the bottom. That loosened up and then it tightened up over the course of my tenure.
But it was always something that I appreciated, because I think in traditional magazine criticism, a lot of people didn't take the short reviews as seriously as the long reviews. Like, you knew if something was 800 words in Rolling Stone, it was written with a little bit more care and seriousness than maybe like the 100 word reviews. But every review was really about it. I remember working so hard on that tiny, tiny review.
Well, The Voice had a legacy. I'm sure, I don't know whether Bob mentioned this or whatever, but there was a time before I was there, and I'm going to get into more about before I was there.
Yeah.
There was more time before I was there than I was there, but where the section was divided into riffs and licks.
Right, yeah, Bob talked
and
about
there,
that.
There would be like these short pieces at the end called licks, which were sometimes maybe a small show review, but might be a reissue review or, say, an EP or a single. I think it's the first place I ever saw singles reviewed like that. And I've always thought that was really interesting. They would be these little 250, 300-word pieces at the end of the section, and I don't want to get too inside baseball, but I thought that was really interesting. And so I can't remember how it was presented to me when I first got there, but somehow there was this format how the first page of the section was supposed to look, where you weren't supposed to have one piece covering up the whole page. It was supposed to be broken up, I guess, for visual reasons.
Yeah.
And I immediately thought of that. And I'm sure that your Freestyle Fellowship piece was along those lines.
And if I'm not mistaken, just to jump ahead a bit, am I wrong in remembering that you submitted to Bob or to The Voice when you were in the Army?
I voted in a couple passing job polls. And then the third time I voted in a poll was, I think, 1983 poll. And I attached an 11-page letter onto my ballot. I was a second lieutenant in the Army in Germany. I technically shouldn't have been able to vote because I wasn't really operating as a music critic then.
Right.
But Bob printed a huge chunk of my ballot essay, spiel, whatever, as part of the voice poll. And he asked me to start writing at that point. So I started writing, you know, professionally, getting paid. I had written a couple of reviews in college, but a handful. But the spring of 84, I started writing. I reviewed a Bad Religion album.
Did you perceive that as like kind of the ne plus ultra of criticism at the time?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was like, I got a check in the mail and I had no idea what the check for. I didn't write the thing thinking that it would get published because nobody had ever been published with it. I mean, I was subscribing to the Voice while living in Germany,
right,
in the Army. It got sent to my APO. I think I got it a couple weeks late.
Sure.
And Bob immediately asked me to start writing for them. By the late 80s, I was probably in the paper pretty much every other week. And I found a niche, basically. I mean, nobody else, it wasn't my only niche, but one of the ways I think I found my way in, I had grown up on, you know, what was called heavy metal then, loud hard rock music in Detroit. And there really weren't critics writing about that at that time. By the early 90s, I had falling out with certain editors. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could be a pain, I think, as a freelancer. And I probably went through a time where I was sort of even kind of burnt out. And I wound up kind of persona non grata in The Voice for a few years. I mean, I don't want to go into too much detail about that, but it's kind of what happened. But I was writing for them again by the late 90s. I had written a couple things for Anne, and then a couple things for Eric Weisbart. And I was editing either maybe a Sheryl Crow piece or a Monster Magnet piece that I had done for Eric. And he basically said, you know, the next time you do the piece, you know, I'm not going to be here anymore. And he said, they're looking for a music editor now. And I'm like, oh, well, maybe I should apply.
Right.
And Eric basically said, I really don't think you have the disposition for it. I think I dropped an email to Doug Simmons, who was managing editor at that point, and he's like, no, go ahead and apply.
Also worth pointing out that my first pitch to you was not my first pitch to The Voice, but Eric rejected my first pitch for The Voice, just to be on the record about that.
I was cranky in the late 90s, and I would like say things about like how every other word in The Voice music section seemed like it was deconstruction or whatever, you know, and I was just, I came from a different school.
Oh, of course. Also, like, and Eric, this will be telling, Eric dinged my first pitch for being, quote, too academic, which I think is hilarious, all things
wow,
told.
I would think that a new writer then would try to make it academic on purpose, but... Apparently, scores of people applied or interviewed for the job. They interviewed me for the job. We went to some restaurant, and I basically was pulled aside, and I said, you know, we're seriously thinking about, you know, hiring you. I wanted to open it up. I wanted to open it up the kind of voices they would have at the section. I wanted to open it up genre-wise.
Yeah,
it bugged me at that time.
Of course.
That it seemed like there were certain kinds of music that just didn't get written about.
Yeah, and then can you talk about some of the writers that you worked with? Because I think you also, in addition to diversifying the sounds, but you also brought in a bunch of other editors.
Yeah, I brought in some crazy people.
Yeah,
there's a guy, Scott Seward in Philly, who would basically, he would apparently write his... He had been working at a bagel shop in Philly, and he was hilarious. He's obviously one of the funniest music writers, I think, ever. But he would, as I understand it, write his pieces out on the back of like a grocery bag, and his wife would type them up and send them to me. He was kind of like an ex-stoner or whatever, but he was hilarious, and he did a lot of stuff. Metal Mike Saunders,
yes,
who had been the singer for the Angry Samoans, and he had actually been the guy who supposedly gave heavy metal its genre name when he was a teenager writing for a publication called Phonograph Record Magazine in the early 70s. But he hadn't written since long before he was fronted a punk rock band. And he was a CPA in a hospital run by nuns in the Bay Area. But he wound up writing mainly for me about stuff he would hear on Radio Disney.
That was like probably the first serious writing I ever saw about music along those lines.
It was. And Mike Saunders' pieces were odd because a lot of them, including the two longest, were not submitted to me as pieces. They were basically submitted piecemeal on the backs of postcards and emails and stuff like that. And I would kind of piece them into a piece. And for the Britney piece and the Radio Disney piece, both of which were, I think, over 4,000 words, and I believe taking up the whole section or very close to it, that's what those were. I mean, maybe he would submit a couple hundred word pieces, and I'm like, God, he left out his best stuff, you know?
Right.
I think the Britney one I kind of did almost as a Metal Mike diary of his thoughts on Britney since he had seen he sent me a postcard the day after he saw the first single on MTV or something like that. He went out and bought the CD single, which had a B-side, which wouldn't end up on her first album. And just his evolving ideas about comparing her voice to like certain R&B-influenced pop singers from the early 60s and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
The Radio Disney thing was, I mean, both of them were hilarious, and I really liked funny writers.
I didn't know some of those backstories that you just told, but like, I'm not surprised by them. Did you feel like part of your mandate was not just to diversify the coverage and diversify the writers, but also to keep a certain tone or energy of eccentricity and outsider spirit for the paper?
I wanted to balance out the tone. I mean, the two people I was required to print, both of whom I think are obviously amazing,
or
Chris Gow and Gary Ginn.
Yeah, of course.
And initially Eric Weisbarb, because that was part of the deal as an outgoing editor. Mm-hmm. And all of them were, I mean, they're all great, great writers with their own voices, but a lot of the writers I like were maybe more frivolous.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, the whole idea of Cream Magazine, when it existed, was you listened to stuff seriously. You listened to music seriously, but you didn't necessarily write about it seriously.
Right.
And then Chris Gow can have a great sense of humor too in his writing. But I mean, that's hardly the main thing people think of him as. I mean, I wanted to surprise people. You know, I mean, I would sometimes make it all hip hop too. And I would sometimes make it all country. You know, I wanted pieces to complement each other, to talk to each other. I liked the idea of a music section being a conversation.
Yes.
And I think I got that from like the letters to Cream, but also from the fanzine world. In a way, it predated a lot of what the internet wound up being. I wanted people to disagree with each other within the section itself.
Yes. And that's, like I said, to me on a week-to-week basis, the eclectic, the eccentric, the Chuck Eddy era is a special time. So I want to so thank you for that, and thanks also for including me in that, and thanks for talking to me today.
I appreciate it, John.
So now we're coming into the mid-2000s, and The Voice at this point, I mean, there's many points of contentiousness in The Voice's history, but in the mid-2000s, the New Times conglomerate takes over Village Voice Media and at some point bring in a new music editor. And that new music editor is Rob Harvilla, and Rob is calling in from Ohio, where I used to get it and still get it, and Rob currently gets it. What's up, Rob?
I'll take your word for it. Hello. Thank you for having me.
And Rob is currently a staff writer at The Ringer, of course, a frequent podcast guest. Rob, it's only right to start off this conversation, this part of the conversation, with our first meeting, which I believe was, I don't know if it was your first day at The Voice, but it was certainly very, very early on. And I think you should go first. You should say what you remember, and then we'll see how that goes.
Well, geez, I started in April of 2006.
And you were coming from the Bay. You were coming from Oakland, right?
From the East Bay Express,
yes.
Which is based in Oakland, basically. And it's, as you said, the New Times conglomerate, which owned the Express. I don't remember when they bought The Voice. It might have been as much as a year earlier. Mm-hmm. But I was installed by them, basically, at The Voice.
A plant, a handsome plant.
Oh, thank you. I'd like to think so. In April of 2006, you know, and the best thing about my first few years at The Voice was that Twitter did not exist.
Oh, yeah.
It was a very ugly time, you know, the talent drain from The Voice at that time, you know, which took in Chuck Eddy, mm-hmm. my predecessor. You know, I worked with Chris Gow for a few months, but, you know, him, Lynn Yeager, you know, Tom Robbins eventually. Mm-hmm. I mean, just a legendarily awful time for the paper in general, you know, and to be sort of the guy, one of the first new people brought in by this new regime, you know, to try and replace these incredible people it was vastly unpleasant. And so when I would meet with every, you know, writer, current staffer or whatever, like I would be very worried, very concerned about, like, you know, whether they were just viewing me as just absolutely the enemy, or were they, you know, sort of willing to hang with me a little bit? And mm-hmm. so I was concerned about you, of course, you know, like I've heard, you know.
Aww. I'm just a little kitten like me.
Oh, well, yeah, it's very quickly. Yes. If I recall, we met like on a tree lawn or something outside The Voice, you know, in whatever era of Cooper Union that was, you know,
that little park, that little triangle park.
Exactly. Yep. Yes. And you were very striking and handsome and jovial person. And I told you that I was going to a Mets game that night and you laughed at me. I don't know why you did that. I believe you had been assigned a feature on TV on the radio.
Accurate.
You know,
accurate.
And I think you weren't sure if it was still on, and I wasn't sure if you still wanted it to be on. Like, basically everyone who I interacted with for those first several months, like, some people were willing to hang in with this and some people weren't, you know, and mm-hmm. I certainly couldn't blame the people who weren't, you know, like this, you know, to whatever degree hostility was coming my way, it was justified. You know, I was trying to replace just incredible legendary people, you know, and just trying to hang in the best I can. And so I recall you as being particularly, you know, nice to me in the midst of that really, really ugly transition. So thank you for that.
That's a very generous read of that meeting. I appreciate it. I do want to underscore something that you allude to, which is that The Voice is very tribal. The Voice has always been very tribal, and it's
sure.
always been one tribe replacing the next. But the second tribe feels just as strongly as the first tribe, and so on and so forth. And I do remember that piece had been assigned, and I had actually done the interviews already and was sort of maybe mid transcription when all the turnover happened. And I was actually worried that you would remember that meeting as like maybe threatening. So I'm glad that is not your memory. Although I fear like maybe it was slightly, because I was like, what's this guy about? He's coming in out of nowhere. He's, you know, my normal editor just got washed out the paint. But I immediately recognized that you were a kindred spirit. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to take my TV, my Pulitzer winning TV on the radio profile. I'm not going to take it to a competitor. You can have it. Oh, I think about it often.
I didn't want to see that in Brooklyn Vegan, you know, or what have you. Wherever you would have gone instead, it would have been a shame. But yeah, I'm glad we were able to establish a rapport.
We really worked it out. Let's talk about the voice, the transitions of the voice in that era, because we're talking the mid-2000s. So what we're really talking about is the internet. So at the same time that you're trying to preserve the critical sensibility of the paper, you're also trying to remake it for the worldwideweb.com.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Paz and Jop, obviously, you know, the year end poll that had been running since the 70s, like the first year I did it, which, you know, I was running it starting in December of 2006. If I recall, that was the first year where you had to vote online.
Whew.
You know, previously up to, you know, 2005, like you could mail in your ballots. Like just the actual logistical process of doing that poll changed very radically just right when I got there, you know, and it's the first few years we tried to do it with this horrible convoluted, you know, Excel spreadsheet where, you know, where it's a bunch of journalists trying to do math, you know, and then amass these ballots from various methods. And like, I'm sure we screwed all kinds of things up. You know, it was only late in my run where, you know, somebody came in who was able to sort of automate it, you know, and do literally in 5 minutes what a staff of people failed to do, you know, over the course of a couple months.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the turnaround also on Paz and Jop, like, I want to say that it used to run in like February or March of the following year, you know,
yes.
Like they had a lot of time, you know, to set up the comments. And obviously the comments were a big deal. Everyone would write in, you know, and Kriskow running it would, you know, print out like hundreds of pages of comments from, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of writers and like comb them and pick the best stuff. And just the process was really elaborate, you know, and sort of multimedia. Whereas for me, like, you know, the new regime wants me to turn it around, you know, in a matter of weeks, you know, put it up in January or whatever. And it's happening entirely online in a system we don't really understand. And again, like, I remember like Christmas Eve is when ballots were due. And I'm like sitting at my parents' house in terror. Like, is anyone going to vote for this thing? You know,
mm-hmm.
Like the new regime had fired Kriskow, I want to say in August or September of that year. Like I only got to work with him for less than half a year. And he was great with me, you know, as a representative of a new regime, like, you know, he was much kinder to me than he had to be or justifiably he could have been. And, you know, to lose him, to lose the face of that poll, like just absolutely the person who invented that poll and shepherded that poll for 3 decades, like I didn't know if anyone was going to vote in it, you know? And again, I wouldn't have blamed anybody. I didn't blame anyone who didn't. You know, and I don't remember like the stats, like the drop off was like probably from 1,000 plus the year before to, you know, probably maybe 500, mm-hmm. maybe 600 people voted my first year, like enough to survive, basically, like no more, but enough to survive. But I'm just sitting there on Christmas Eve, like just refreshing the page that tells me how many people are voting. And it's just like, do we still have a thing here? You know, and barely we did. But those first few years, especially, you know, it was rocky.
That's a beautiful image that I've never thought of. You sort of like moping in your parents' home on Christmas Eve,
God,
refreshing the website.
Just me like playing Xbox 360 and feeling sorry for myself. A lot of that in those years. You know, my now wife, I'm sure, is very grateful that, you know, those years are over.
What did you feel were the most important things to preserve from what you had been handed? And what did you try to bring in that was new?
You know, like the new regime's buzzword, like, you know, the ultimate evil was to be cerebral, you know, and that was applied to a few writers in particular, but to the section as a whole, you know, and Chuck Eddy had run it and just incredibly smart, incredibly thoughtful, incredibly detailed writers and pieces, features, reviews, you know, it's just there was nothing like it. And there hasn't really since been anything like it, you know, and famously, I think both Chuck and Kriskow would do their edits in person, either over the phone or in person,
mm-hmm.
but like sitting there with the writer and
yep.
going line by line, like that's the way that I edited or tried to edit Kriskow. And it's like, it's monumentally intimidating, yep. you know, to try and do something like that. And so I was trying to find a balance. Like, as you said, like, The Voice is a place like SNL, you know, where, like, it's whatever era it's in, like, it's dead compared to the era previous.
Like, sure.
It's never as good as it used to be. Yep. But, like, my break, you know, the new company coming in, that was a hard break.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a weird sensation this week to sort of realize that the version of the paper that people are mourning right now is not my version, you know, at all. And it's, you know, I'm proud of the work that I did there, and I'm thrilled to have worked with the people who I worked with. But it's just, it was a hard break and a totally new regime. And I was just trying to find a way to honor the past. I don't know, like, New Times at that time, they had, I don't know, 11 to 13 papers, yep. you know, as scattered as California, Texas. They were based in Phoenix and Denver. And there were good writers, good young writers at those papers. And you were supposed to share stories, you know, like reprint.
I remember pieces. That, yeah.
Right. And so it's, some great writing came out of that. And so in maybe a funnier, shorter, breezier, like, weirder sort of vibe to that stuff, and particularly to the stuff, you know, that I was drawn to, that I was writing, the writers who I had been using at The Express and in my previous jobs. Like, if there was some new sensibility I was trying to bring to it, maybe it was that. But for me, it was much more about just trying to smuggle in as much of the past into the future as possible. You know, like, I'm getting a pretty close look from the corporate guys, and they pretty quickly, I think, grow disillusioned with me, because I think they sort of expected me to come in and just want to burn it all down and just disavow, you know, the past and the writers of the past and the approach of the past. And I was very much trying to keep as much of that alive as I could.
You were the resistance.
I guess so. That sounds really self-aggrandizing, you know, like.
Well, let me aggrandize for you. You don't have to aggrandize yourself.
Thank you.
Let me aggrandize for you.
Thank goodness.
But I think a lot of the thing, like, when I think of The Voice of that era upholding the values of the previous era, a lot of it is online. And I wonder if you could talk about that sort of, maybe that generation of web writers and bloggers and what you were hoping to achieve.
I mean, another traumatic thing that happened, like, I think right before I got there, was Nick Sylvester left, you know, the paper. And Nick did incredible stuff blogging. And Tom Bryan, who I think you talked to, likewise, mm-hmm. you know, Status Ain't Hood and that stuff he did. Like, he was one of the first and one of the best to sort of bridge, you know, that old classic voice, like, very thoughtful, very detailed vibe with, like, daily immediate yes. internet writing,
takes.
Which he's still doing, you know, it's
Tom B. Yeah. Tom B. Just a giant of the form, literally and metaphorically.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, lots of people have tried to do what he does, but to this day, you know, they can't do it the way he did it. Mm-hmm. And so he was crucial. You know, Zach Baron was awesome, you know, both as an editor, as sort of just an overall shaper of the section as we moved it forward, and just the blogging that he did. You know, Joe, of course, you know, we tried to make it more immediate and just quicker and faster. And I guess, I don't know how to put it, like, not, I don't know. It's weird to think about that as the bloggy era. And, like, those first few years, you know, a previous regime of Gawker just trashed us mercilessly. You know, it
right.
feels like almost daily. Like, it's weird to think about the battle lines and, like, the philosophy of the way the web was now, the web was then, as opposed to now, and just the way that the teams change. It just feels like a lifetime ago.
Oh, it does. I mean, like, when I think of The Voice, like, the era that I grew up on, there's something, it's so crucial, but it's also very it's, like, fixed. You'd be like, The Voice in the 90s or The Voice in the 80s, and that's, like, one big thing. But, like, you can actually start micro slicing once you get up to the mid to late 2000s into the 2010s, and it just changes. It evolves faster. Part of that's because of the internet. Part of that's because of corporate turnover. It just changes quite a bit. And so eventually you left The Voice, and you also left New York. I remember we had a very long conversation about that when you left, which I hope still rings in your brain.
It does.
Good. So Joe Coscarelli, told me a story about your farewell toast or farewell party, and about a story you told at that party that I think is a fitting way to close out this conversation. So if you don't mind sharing that with us, have at it.
Okay. It's it's so convoluted. All right, so Gawker Media at that time has started a site, a music site called Idolator.
Yes.
And it is run in its first iteration by Maura Johnston and Brian Rafferty.
R.I.P. Idolator 1.0. Not
absolutely.
Not any subsequent iterations.
Right, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it was a great site that was definitely, you know, conceived as a direct challenge to us.
Yes.
You know, which again was a totally justifiable lane to try and fill. And that came especially to Paz and Jop. You know, as I said, Bob Criscow is synonymous with Paz and Jop. He started it, he ran it, he wrote the giant essay, you know, that accompanied it every year, like it was his thing, you know. And when he left, when they fired him, which I want to say was like August or September of that year, I was just like, is there any way anyone's going to vote in Paz and Jop? Is there any way that anyone is going to do this with us, you know? And another way that Criscow was incredibly, you know, kind to me was just one word from Criscow, like, screw this guy, don't ever talk to him again. And everybody would have listened and everyone would have been justified in doing so. You know, that he gave me any kind of chance to do that on my own, it was a very generous thing. So Idolator announces its own year-end poll, which I believe was called Jack and Pop, you know.
Okay, yep.
Right, and they say very explicitly, I think it was run by Mara and Michelangelo Matos, the critic.
True story. Author.
And then they say very explicitly, like, we're taking this thing over. Like, we're better stewards for this thing. We understand it better. We can do it better. You know, and that's a legitimate challenge, you know, a completely understandable thing to try and do. And they did it, and they did a great job with it. And we ran neck and neck, you know. And again, like, I'm sitting there refreshing the numbers, and I don't remember the numbers, but they were, I don't remember who had more. It was within the margin of error, you know. But I was terrified that whole time that they would have twice, three times as many people as we did, and that would be the end of it. But anyway, you know, there's a lot of sniping in this period, you know, and the New Times way is to be pretty combative and to go after critics and stuff. And again, like, that's not really my personality. And again, I think they were disappointed in my unwillingness to sort of take on my critics and my skeptics directly. You know, like, I understood completely why people did not like me at all and wouldn't want to deal with me. And I was trying to win them over.
Right.
Whereas New Times would have greatly preferred that I just try and steamroll them out of existence, you know, which I don't think would have worked if anyone would have tried, and it certainly wouldn't have worked if I had.
Sure.
You know, I'm a nice, sheepish Midwestern boy at heart, unfortunately.
And also one of the most incisive, vivid, and jubilant critics of our era.
Oh, God. Well, thank you so much for that.
Don't sell yourself short, dog.
Anyway, you know, New Times is following, you know, the sort of sniping between us and Idolator, or whatever, you know, rivalry is brewing there after that poll Jack and Pop has announced. And I don't think I ever even tried to write, like, the Criscow, like, 5,000-word overview. I was like, this, I'm not going to be able to do this. You know, I don't remember how many, but I just tried to get 8 to 10 people. And again, a mix of new people.
Sure.
And legacy people to sort of replace that. You know, I wanted to get Chuck Eddy, and Chuck Eddy is another guy who was much, much kinder to me than that situation, you know, you would think would demand. And he wrote something, I want to say, and that was very important to me as well, to have, you know, his imprimatur of at least, like, giving me a chance, you know, to do it, to try this. And so, anyway, New Times isn't really down with my approach. And at the 11th hour, they decide that they want to run as the lead essay, like, this very, very combative, you know, sort of screw the haters, you know, meet the new boss, you know, much better than the old boss sort of screed, you know, that calls out Idolator and, like, the people running that poll pretty explicitly. And just, it's very much their style and very much not my style.
Doesn't this all seem so ridiculous in retrospect?
It seems incredible. Again, it's like the Civil War far away from me. Like, it's very difficult to conceive of this. You know, again, just the way the internet was and who the media players were, it's bizarre to think that this is 10 years and change ago.
Yeah.
This is only 12 years ago.
Yeah.
It feels several centuries ago. This is a sidebar, but I have a vivid memory of reading that and understanding that I was meant to put that on the internet in basically my name. And I remember walking up and down the Borough Hall platform of the subway, the R line,
good
listening to the Spring Awakening soundtrack on repeat and just thinking like, I'm dead. I am dead. I am dead if I run this. I am dead if I don't run this. Like, this is the end. And I talked them out of it, and I don't know how. I think I agreed to write something combative, and then the thing I wrote was not at all combative. Like, I sort of head-faked them out of running that, but it leaked on Idolater.
Mysteriously leaked? Did it mysteriously leak?
It was not me. I think I'm pretty sure I know how it got there, but it was not me, and it was not my machinations. I can't believe how lucky I am that Twitter didn't exist. I would have jumped off a bridge, you know. Very
Rob,
great.
Rest assured, I would have caught you.
Oh, that's very sweet.
Rob, thank you for your time, your reflections, and for your service. Mr. Califat! Being double girl, show me what you're working with. Being double girl, show me what you're working with. Being double girl, show me what you're working with. Being double girl, show me what you're working with. Now we're approaching the end of this podcast retrospective on The Voice, and I wanted to bring it up as close to the present as I could. And one of the things that The Voice was really good at in the 2000s was adapting to the internet. And the bloggers of The Voice of the 2000s all had very signature voices, a lot of passion, a lot of fervor, and really were doing takes before takes, but doing them in a very smart and efficient way. And so that's, on one side, it's Nick Sylvester, on another side, it's Zach Barron, and right there in the middle, it's Tom Bryan. Tom B wrote Status Ain't Hood, which was a daily column on VillageVoice.com from 2005 to 2008. And Tom B is currently a senior editor at Stereogum, and he is calling in from Charlottesville, Virginia, outside his kid's kung fu class right now. Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm doing real good, man. How about you?
I'm great. I'm happy. Thank you for coming to talk a little bit of The Voice today. So one of the things that you were kind of writing in kind of the first era, I think it was sort of the first era of internet outrage, maybe. That was it was a golden 1.0 moment for internet outrage. And I think one of the things that you were always very good at was stoking some of that but doing it not in a trolly way. Like, I think you genuinely wanted to be in the fray, I always felt, when I read you.
Well, and one thing, you know what they say, John.
Tell me.
That the avant-garde need not be moral.
Someone said that. I can't remember who said that, but that person was 95% right. What can I say? We should probably just jump right into it. And there's the elephant on the internet is you are responsible for kind of one of the most iconic and most discussed and argued over headlines, more of a headline than a piece, but the headline is what got all the attention in Voice history. And that is, of course, the legendary Pitbull, better than Nas. And so let's just kind of get right into it. Do you still stand by that? Was Pitbull better than Nas, and is Pitbull better than Nas?
Well, you know, I wrote that at a very different point in the career arc of both Pitbull and Nas.
Yes, this is 2006. 2006, just for context.
Mr. 305 at the time.
Yes.
He was not yet Mr. Worldwide. He had a much smaller constituency to represent.
Very true.
Nas was going through some things. Nas is perpetually going through some things. But he was making some really bad music right around then.
A feature, not a bug.
Yes, indeed. You know, at the time, I felt like Pitbull was making some, like, fun, exciting music that I wanted to write about. And the way it went back then is you just slap some goofy-ass headline on there and people would click. The word clickbait had not been invented, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that is very much what that headline was. But I really liked Pitbull. I had fun writing about him. And at that moment in time, yeah, I would rather listen to some new Pitbull than some new Nas. You want to ask me about now? About 2018 Pitbull versus 2018 Nas?
Yeah, let's go in.
All right, let's do it. Well, see, the thing is, Pitbull and Nas have both released garbage albums in the year of our Lord 2018.
True story.
But they are very different garbage albums. Nas released a garbage album that was produced by Kanye West as part of his whole let's put out all this music in Wyoming type of initiative that you covered very thoroughly.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So people actually expected that album to be good. It had expectations. It had hopes and dreams attached to it. Pitbull released the soundtrack to the motion picture Gotti, the directorial debut from the guy who played E on Entourage.
Mm-hmm.
And that album had no expectations attached to it. It did not break anybody's heart. Nobody expected it to be good. and it was not good. So therefore,
So Pitbull. So then, I have to ask: Pitbull still better than Nas? Question mark.
Absolutely. 100%.
Flip this track again, y'all. NYC, Dirty South, West Coast, Midwest, let's go. If hip hop should die before I wake, I put an X.
Well, that's our show, I guess. Thank you to everybody who came through and called for the last two episodes. I want to say there are so many tremendous writers that I've read in The Voice over the years. There's no way I could have possibly captured them all. Just to run down a quick list of folks, just a little bit of a roll call. Greg Tate, who I tried to get, but he's in Germany this week. So I'm sorry to miss Greg, but Greg's one of the most formative people on my critical sensibility, and that's all because of The Village Voice. Here's just a bunch of folks: Carol Cooper, Richard Goldstein, Eric Weisbard, Jim Wolcott, Doug Simmons, Vernon Gibbs, Michelle Wallace, Mim Yudovich, Lisa Jones, Vince Aletti. Vince Aletti on Disco, read everything you can. Obviously, Lester Bangs, RJ Smith, Gary Giddens, Joan Morgan, Michael Gonzalez, Barry Michael Cooper, Candia Crazy Horse, Colson Whitehead, Nick Sylvester, Zach Barron, Ed Morales, Barry Walters, Teray, Trisha Romano. Special shouts out to Dennis Lim, who used to edit my live show reviews and also let me write about a couple of films, and to Deshaun Bosler, who was the listings editor when I used to fiend for $10 checks. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us any voice memories or alt weekly memories at podcast@nytimes.com. Subscribe to the podcast anywhere you get your audio content: iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, etc. Our producer, Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, back next week. Kidnappings, project billings, drug dealings. Criticize that. Why is that? Because Nas rap is compared to legitimized crap. Because we love to talk on nasty chickens. Most intellectuals will only half listen. So you can't blame jazz musicians or David Stern with his NBA fashion issues. Oh, I think they like me in my white tee. You can't ice me. We here for life, B. On my second marriage, hip-hop's my first wifey. And for that, we're not taking it lightly. If hip-hop should die, we...